From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Kristen Finch knew her husband, David, had issues, that he was obsessive about his routine, that he could freak out at the unexpected, that he would miss social cues. When they were dating, it all seemed harmless enough. He was quirky, she told herself. But after a few years of marriage, the quirkiness looked more like emotional distance and inflexibility. The relationship wasn't working. But Kristen had a hunch, and one day she gave David an online test. Turns out he had Asperger's syndrome. David Finch has written a book about the revelation and how it made him determined to understand how his brain worked and how he could make himself a better person and husband. He'll join us today to talk about the effort, his Journal of Best Practices. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We'll get to the details as we go, but suffice it to say right now that at 30 years old and 5 years into his marriage, David Finch learned he had Asperger's syndrome. His wife had noticed it, of course, that he was obsessive about his routine, that he could freak out about the unexpected, that he could miss social cues. And it may seem surprising, but David says the news didn't really unsettle him, kind of relieved him. He's described the moment of knowing as sublime, said that it almost felt as though he was present at his own birth. Now so much made sense. David Finch has written a book about the experience, how the diagnosis didn't freak him out, and how it sent him on this quest to understand himself and to be a better person and a better husband. The book is called The Journal of Best Practices, a memoir of marriage, Asperger's syndrome, and one man's quest to be a better husband. And he's joining us today from his hometown of McHenry, Illinois. And David Finch, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, I guess some people have heard the story, some haven't. Let's start with, in March 2008. This is March 14th. It's Pi Day, which is kind of a big deal for you, right?
It's a big deal to me, big deal to nerds in general, yes.
Yeah.
You know, Pi Day, the number obviously 3.14, March 14th. You know, not exactly self-explanatory story to all the cool kids, but to people like me, it made a lot of sense. And, yeah, this was a remarkable day for me.
You're 30 years old. As I said, you'd been married 5 years. And we should say your wife, Kristen, she had had this hunch about you for years. Let's talk about the day or the evening anyway, because I think it kind of reveals certain things about you. I mean, you talk about how you had gotten home that evening, and you had started what you call your evening routine, which we should mention. Routines were really important for you.
Yeah, they certainly are. You know, routine. You know, as it relates to the autistic mind, is something that's very important. You know, we're often so busy, and I say we, I mean people anywhere on the autism spectrum. You know, and certainly I'm pretty far on the Asperger side of things. But in any case, yeah, the sense of routine is very important. Helps us to feel grounded. You know, where I'm at is my mind is often, you know, processing so many things at such a frenetic pace, and there's a lot of sensory input coming in that I'm, you know, dealing with and trying to make sense of people's facial expressions all day long. And so when you're kind of hyper-processing the things that a lot of people just sort of do on autopilot, the sense of routine is just something that helps me to feel grounded. It's predictable. It's reliable. I don't have to think about what's happening next. It's just kind of like one less bag to have to carry, essentially, if my days are completely repeatable.
So you're going through the routine, and Kristen asks you to come down into the basement, where she's in front of this computer, and you don't have any idea at this point what's really going on.
No, not at all. Kristen, I should explain here, is a speech therapist.
Yeah.
And she'd been working with kids with autism. And the reason why she stumbled upon this this test that she wanted me to take, she was sitting at her computer down in our basement, which is where her office kind of was. And, you know, she had been researching Asperger's more and more as she started to work more with children with Asperger's and not so much autism, but kind of opened up her scope a little bit. And and she stumbled upon this this evaluation. Yeah. And she called me down into the basement one evening, and and she just said, park yourself right here next to me, and I want you to answer some questions for me. And again, I had no idea. I was what I always tell people is that I honestly assumed I was going to be taking like a Cosmo quiz.
Right.
that she found one of these things, to determine what kind of what kind of dinners I should be eating this summer or whatever the Cosmo quiz would reveal. And
yeah.
Sure enough, it was one question after another that was just delivering these profound payouts. And I thought, well, this is no Cosmo quiz.
Yeah, yeah. At what point so you're going through these, there's 150 of these questions. Do you get stuck on details? Do you miss the overall picture? Do you notice patterns in things? Question after question after question. And a lot of them, a good part of them, you're responding yes, yes. Some of them, you're pretty emphatic about the yes. At what point is it starting to dawn on you that something's going on? Wait a minute, what is this saying about me?
Yeah, it didn't take long.
Yeah, yeah.
The first few questions were just kind of vanilla questions, things that I thought anybody could, answer yes or no to. It was like, do you find it vitally important to remain undisturbed when you're focusing on things that are important to you, your special interests and things? And it's like, yeah, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
As we got into it, and she started hitting on questions that were a little more personally revealing that I thought were kind of written specifically for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was things like, do you need extended periods of time to sort of visualize yourself in a social situation before entering it?
Right.
Do you find it's you're more successful if you script out potential conversations before you have them? And after spending time around people, do you often replay the things, the sights and sounds, in a loop?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, yeah, I do all of that. Like, how did this computer quiz know?
Yeah,
I seriously thought that the quiz could have absolutely been written for me if somebody had gone in and like cracked open my notebook and was reading my personal notes to myself. And that's when I started, it wasn't cathartic yet. It was at that moment when I was still answering questions. It was a little eye-opening, maybe a little mind-blowing at times, and really emotional. There were moments when a question, just the way that I answered it and finally giving an honest answer, and Kristen's reaction to my answer of, how difficult it is to socialize, or how I often feel like I'm kind of playing a game and pretending to be like people around me.
Yeah.
To kind of say those words and admit them made me tear up, and didn't expect that to happen at all. But all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed with these emotions. Like, yes, this is my daily reality. Like, thank God somebody's bringing it to this attention. And it wasn't until we got to the end, actually, when Kristen was just looking at me, and I'm sitting there just like laying flat on my back practically.
Wow.
And she said, what do you think? And and I told her, oh my gosh, I think that's an unbelievably telling list of questions. What is this? And that's when she said, this is an Asperger's evaluation. Mm. Everything just clicked. It was like somebody just opened the curtains and I could see everything just perfectly clearly. Oh, it all makes sense.
Yeah.
And
I wanted to play this moment from a conversation you and Kristen had with Ira Glass for the program This American Life. I think it'd be nice to hear Kristen's voice.
Yeah.
As part of this. And this is sort of that moment when you come to the end of the quiz.
And so you get to the end, and then what do you say? Like, how do you break the news?
Well, at the very end, you just like calculate. And so when the quiz got done, before I hit calculate, I told him what it was. And, he was like, oh, okay. So I'm like, are you ready to calculate? So I hit the button and it was a big old yes.
It was such a huge moment, sublime moment. It's a weird way to say it, but I almost felt as though I was present at my own birth, if that's a decent way of saying that. I mean, it was as if somebody had finally handed me a user manual for myself. Here's how you operate, and if you read this manual, everything that was difficult in life before is going to be a lot easier now because it makes sense and you can learn how to control certain things.
You write about in the book that one of the most remarkable parts about that evening was just how it seemed to draw you so close to Kristen. Because, of course, your relationship had really kind of fallen into disrepair. But you guys were becoming drawn together again.
Yeah, that's exactly. I'm so glad you say that. That was the huge payoff. That was what changed everything in an instant. We had been so estranged from each other. We didn't even feel like friends at that point. You know, we had been best friends since high school, and we felt like we weren't connecting. We didn't really even know who each other were anymore. We just, you know, who's this person I married? It doesn't make sense. And hadn't laughed very much. You know, things were bad. Marriage was teetering on the verge of failure. It was bleak and a scary, confusing time for both of us. And suddenly we're in this moment of pure recognition, and all of a sudden just her eyes softened, and we felt close again. Instantly I felt like I was understood. She felt like she finally understood me, and she looked at me and said, we're going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. And this makes a lot of sense. And so it's not like in an instant everything was fixed or repaired. You know, our marriage, we still had a lot of things we had to roll up our sleeves and get to work repairing some of the things in our marriage that were really holding us both at a disadvantage. But at least we had a starting point, and we had a path, like a trajectory that we could see unfolding before our eyes. Oh, these are some of the things that are difficult for me, just as a person, but also as a husband, you know, tuning into the needs of others, being responsive to people, understanding there's a world outside of me that I need to pay attention to. And I think the beauty in that moment was that we were immediately drawn closer together, and we said, "Hey, we're a team again. Let's fix this. This is actually pretty great news." This user manual that we've been handed, and that's when we got to work.
You know, the book, a lot of it is about your relationship. I mean, you were really good platonic friends throughout high school. I mean, not just friends. I mean, best friends. And you had this connection that's really extraordinary. I mean, it was platonic, as you say, at first. But this question comes up all the time, I guess. How is it that you got together in the first place when you had these kinds of behaviors? I mean, what was she seeing? Because she saw, she figured it was quirky, I guess. But she also, I mean, this was the part that she also loved about you. But it's also the part that changed when you got married, too. I mean, talk about that.
Well, yeah. You know, I write in the book that quirks are like sneezes or energetic puppies. Yeah. One or two aren't so bad, but then when you're trying to deal with like 10,000 of them, it gets a little much. But, you know, as for how she fell in love with me, I mean, you know, I'm as handsome and charming as George Clooney. I mean, what's not to love? No, I don't know what exactly how I tricked her, but... No, in high school for sure. We were very much platonic friends. There were moments when I was feeling like we were platonic friends only because there was no other option. Because you know, I didn't. You know, there was no possible way I could win her over. She was in just a completely different league. I mean, she was a year older. She was popular, but like not the cool kind of popular. Just the very likable kind of popular. Everybody just kind of was drawn to her. She just had this warmth for people and. I was certainly one of those people who was drawn to her, and she got me, and I think that was our immediate first connection. Was she, I could get her laughing in a way that really nobody else could, and she would laugh in a way that none of my friends, you know, could laugh. She got it. She really connected to what I was saying, and she found the exact same things funny, and I didn't have to explain to her why things were funny. I could just do something funny, and she'd get it, and so that's where things started, and... You know, around the other kids, I could be one person or another. I had all these different personalities I just kind of took off the rack and put on for any situation at hand. Like, you know, like little dopey superhero uniforms. Okay, so if I'm going to be hanging out with the jocks, here's my jock outfit, and I put on this persona, and I'm, you know, and I'm the athletic guy for the afternoon if I need to be. It was always a depleting chore. It was really taxing talking to the different people, you know, in my life. And with Kristen, it was not. It was something I really looked forward to. I didn't feel like I sat there and had to rehearse everything I had to say, and I didn't have to be any one thing or another. I could just sit down, plop down next to her in a chair, and we'd talk and laugh for hours if we were together that long. You know, we went away to college, and our friendship grew even stronger. And she then, after grad school, suffered this profoundly, you know, terrible personal tragedy.
Yeah.
Lost somebody very close and important to her. And, you know, she wasn't herself for a year, and you couldn't expect anyone to be losing somebody that close. And I didn't know how to be there for her as a friend. For the first time in our entire relationship, I didn't know what to do. That was kind of beyond the realm of possibility for me, how to go in there and really be emotionally supportive. And so I just kind of held back.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't hang out much. We talked a couple times on the phone, but for like more than a year, we didn't really see each other. And, you know, one night we just, she called me out of the blue. We happened to be just totally by chance. We happened to end up living in the same town, the same suburb of Chicago, directly across the street from each other. And she just called me one night and said, you know, listen, I'm going to go get a cup of coffee. You want to come with? And of course, I was ready to jump all over that. And I said, yeah, let's do this. I haven't seen you in a long time. And now here's where it kind of got interesting was that her friends, her girlfriends, sorority sisters who had been helping her through all this and her family, they all have tact. Like they have some emotional intuition that prevents them from asking these horrible Barbara Walters questions that are like, you know, just mortifying. I don't.
Yeah.
And so we sat down for coffee and I just launched right into it. You know, how have you been feeling? And she would say like, oh, you know, it's okay. It's been kind of a hard week. Now her other friends knew enough at that point to be like, okay, good enough.
Yeah.
And they would change the topic, get off it. She doesn't want to go there. And you know, again, not me. I persisted. I had no clue what was going on. So it's just like, okay, well, why was it hard? You know, was it hard because you have all this regret over, you know, time you lost with this person? And all of a sudden, boom, there she is, and opening up. It was very therapeutic. She could get all this stuff off her chest finally. Now, I wasn't getting completely overwhelmed and absorbed in the emotions.
Yeah.
And she was essentially talking to like a wall with a face. And it was very therapeutic. It was almost like she was writing it. She had a journal in front of her, and she was getting all this stuff off her chest finally to a friend. She hadn't been able to say any of this to anybody for a long time, and it felt good. And then, you know, when she was done talking, her eyes would be, like, puffy with tears. And I'd launch into another horrible question, you know.
Yeah.
I'd say, like, well, it doesn't sound like you're allowing yourself to be particularly happy, and here's why. You know, outside looking in, I think that you've got to overcome this issue first if you want to get your act together. And, you know, then she would talk for another couple hours, and it felt amazing to get all this off her chest. And then I would do something idiotic, like try to put my leg behind my head and show her how hard it is, you know, to do that. And she would just start laughing. But she would be laughing for the first time in, like, weeks and feeling good about herself and about life. And it was transformative. And so it's kind of ironic that my complete inability to, like, get absorbed in those emotions and conjure, you know, those feelings, have the empathy, really helped us out.
Wow.
And I think that that's where, you know, in those long talks, we started having coffee more and more, and then it became dinner every night, and then, you know, going to movies together, and we just spent a lot of time together, and that's when feelings started to develop. And we took a big chance and said, you know, let's follow this. This seems to be where it's headed, and let's, you know, let's give this a shot.
Yeah.
And hopefully when all is said and done, I can make it all worth the while.
You know, you say in the book that these behaviors that you had, you know, in high school and college, I mean, you could mask them. It's interesting to say because, I mean, obviously this implies that you had this awareness of these behaviors. I mean, was there ever a point when you figured this is just how everyone is? Or was there some point when you figured, you know, I'm not really like most people?
Yeah, I started to sense that, you know, pretty early on in school. I can't pinpoint it exactly, but, you know, I started to tell, like, oh, okay, like, other kids just seem to know what's going on, like at recess.
Yeah.
You go outside, and other kids are just forming little groups, and they're playing, you know, tetherball, or they're playing G.I. Joes, or whatever they're doing. And then there was always me, like, what should I be doing? Nobody's telling me what to do. Like, nobody's telling me how to go and socialize with these kids. So there was that, but I also understood social capital pretty early on. I mean, this started second, third, fourth grade.
Yeah.
You know, I could start to see who the popular kids were, who had a rougher time in school, getting picked on, who were not favored by teachers, and this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, I tried to, quite frankly, just tried to mimic the kids who seemed to be doing it right, who weren't getting in trouble all the time, who weren't getting picked on all the time. And so it wasn't necessarily a conscious decision. It wasn't calculated, like, ooh, I better act like this kid.
Yeah.
It was more just instinct took over, and I'm glad I have that instinct. You know, I think if I just didn't have the instinct to want to try to fit in and to modify my behaviors to accomplish that, going all the way back to when I was a real little kid, life would have turned out, I think, differently.
Yeah.
And, you know, for some people, they don't have that instinct. And, you know, they're Asperger's or not, they're just going to be who they're going to be. And sometimes, you know, a person's take me or leave me attitude, you know, a lot of people leave them. And that's just how it goes. But, you know, by the time I got older, I could learn to manage things consciously. And certainly, after I received the diagnosis, and everything started clicking for me in terms of, like, how my brain processes things, how my mind works. I never felt like I had to change. Like, I never felt as though Kristen was saying, like, we got to fundamentally change who you are. In fact, it was just the opposite. My initial impulse was saying, hey, I should probably change all these characteristics of myself and erase Asperger's. And if I do that, then we'll be home free. Our marriage will get back on track, and I'll be, like, just totally popular guy. And Kristen actually was the one who sat me down and said, listen, it doesn't work that way. This brain of yours, you know, makes you who you are, and we don't want to change that. If there are things that you want to learn how to do to make yourself more successful in life, if there's challenges you have that you're facing that you want to overcome, then I'll help you get there, because, you know, she had all this experience with, you know, how autism worked and manifested itself. You know, I'll help you get there if you want to come seek me for help, or if you want to go get help from a professional, whatever you want to do, just do it. But, you know, don't think that you have to change for me. Please don't change. Let's work on fixing the relationship, not changing you. And that's was a very merciful thing to say, and it helped me to understand, oh, okay, this isn't about changing me. Now, I think there are a lot of people who would strongly advocate. There's this whole neurodiversity movement, you know, out there that strongly advocates, like, no. It's not, the onus does not go to the autistic individual for having to change. The world should change to adapt to us. And that's perfectly valid. I think that if that's someone's worldview, that's great. In an ideal world, there will be understanding on both sides of the fence, and everybody is just who they are, and that's fine. My perspective on that is slightly different. I happen to feel that, you know, we are the 1%. You know, there's diagnosis rate, the CDC just changed it to 1 in 88 kids being diagnosed with some form of autism. And so, you know, when you're asking 99% of the world to change their understanding of you and change how they do things for you, would be excellent if that would work that way. But I'm a realist, and I know that probably can't happen right away. So there are things that I can do to integrate myself a little more smoothly into the neurotypical world in which I live, and I'm willing to do those things. And the only reason I bring that up is because the neurotypical world in which I live happens to include a marriage. And I did make vows to do what love called me to do, to be a good husband. And some of the things I could learn how to do was managing some of the deficits that are attendant with my disorder in a way that would help me to be the husband that I wanted to be. Not the husband that, you know, Kristen said, here's who you should be, but to have the marriage that I wanted to have. I knew there were things I could fix. And I think that goes beyond Asperger's. I think every marriage, you know, that there's a husband and a wife who definitely have their own things that they need to work on in the relationship to make it thrive.
David Finch is with us. His book is called The Journal of Best Practices, a memoir of marriage, Asperger syndrome, and one man's quest to be a better husband. He also blogs for the magazine Psychology Today. You can find a link to that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. About 5 years into the marriage of David and Kristen Finch, they discovered that David had Asperger's syndrome. One day they took a test and everything started to make sense. His strange routines, his emotional distance, his missing of social cues. David Finch has written a book about this experience, how the diagnosis didn't freak him out. It comforted him in many ways and set him off on this quest to understand himself and be a better person and husband. His book is called The Journal of Best Practices, and he's joining us to talk about it today. Let's take a call from Ben, who's joining us in St. George. Ben, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Doug. I really like your show very much, and I wanted to thank David for burying his soul on the air like this. I heard about his story 2 or 3 months ago, and I sought out the test and took it myself. And so my question was, David, did you seek professional diagnosis of your condition, or did you rely on your wife's professional expertise alone? And my second part is, if you did seek a professional diagnosis, how did you go about finding a clinician that, as an adult, could help you learn about your condition, a condition that is typically diagnosed in children? Thank you.
Yeah, those are excellent questions, and I'm glad you're asking this because, you know, when I go around and talk places, I do get this question a lot, and so I think this is a very important thing. When I, the moment that my score was revealed on that self-evaluation, you know, Kristen was sure to point out, listen, I can't tell you that you have Asperger's, you know, I'm not a doctor. I think you might have it, and this test is certainly indicating that you could go and seek a diagnosis from a professional, and they would most likely give you the diagnosis, but technically this isn't a diagnosis. All that aside, in that moment, I knew. I was like, okay, I fit this profile. If this is what we're calling Asperger's syndrome, then my life experiences all add up to me fitting this profile, like, to the letter. So it made sense for me, and it clicked for me then. And just because I wanted the knowledge for myself, I was like, well, you know, I was, I'll admit, conflicted, and still am today. The more people that I meet with Asperger's, the more I'm conflicted. Do I have that then?
Wow.
And yet the answer is yes, of course I fit the profile. You look at the DSMV and the diagnosis writes itself. But at the same time, it is a spectrum, so it's a confusing thing.
Yeah.
You know, my level of impairment in some areas is different than others. And I look at somebody with Asperger's who is struggling really hard with something that I don't have a hard time with, and I think, well, how can we both have the same diagnosis? Nevertheless, I did go and seek a few months later a diagnosis. I contacted a psychologist, licensed clinical psychologist, you know, a PhD, and they referred to the DSM-5, and I, you know, we had a long discussion. So the process for finding that is I knew people who knew people, and they said, you know, you could contact this person or that person. I just threw a dart and went with somebody. But all I was looking for was confirmation. Is this Asperger's, like the quiz says, or is it a bunch of things that add up to look like Asperger's? You wouldn't exactly call it that. Or is there even a difference? So what the doctor confirmed for me was that, like, yeah, according to the DSM-4, this is exactly what we would call Asperger's syndrome. And that's where my engagement in terms of professional help stopped. And I want to clarify something very important. Like, for me, it was enough to know it.
Yeah.
And, okay, that's good, thank you, paid my bill, and that was it. Kristen and I started working together. She understood me. She understood the autistic brain from all of her years of working as a speech therapist. She understood me from all of our years of close friendship, and she got me. So we worked on our marriage together. Sometimes it was really hard, and progress was slow sometimes. And if we had gone to a marriage and family therapist, you know, we probably could have cracked the nut a little sooner, but really we were making progress, and we were doing it in our own way, and it was effective. Had it not been effective, we definitely would have gone and gotten clinical, you know, help from somewhere, from like a professional. I kind of outline all this in the book, but I I do want people to understand it's not going to work for everybody. Yeah. And not everybody can just brute force their way into new behaviors and work with their spouse in a way that's very therapeutic. It's a lot to ask of any spouse, first of all. And second, not everybody has the understanding or the awareness or the patience to do it. And then in those cases, I think people definitely can avail themselves to the resources that are out there that do help older individuals on the spectrum to learn more about how their brain is working and help them to live more fulfilling lives if they choose to. Mm.
Ira Glass mentions in that conversation with you and Kristen that in that episode anyway, that a couples counselor had once told him that every woman who hears about Asperger's for the first time thinks her husband has it. You know
it's
what I mean?
True.
So I'm wondering if you worry that people are going to start kind of misdiagnosing themselves or using it as a crutch for behavior. I mean, what do you make of that?
That's an interestingly worded question. I assumed that human nature being what it is, that people could certainly use this as a crutch.
Yeah.
People could certainly say like, oh, it's my Asperger's flared up at that party. Sorry, I was just horrible to everybody. You know, I'm going to play the Asperger's card. Can't do that. Like, if it explains a lot, great. But what are you going to do with that information? Are you going to just use it as your get out of jail free card and alienate people? Or are you going to use it and say like, oh, okay, so I am wired differently. And, here's how I can kind of navigate my day and in a way that's going to be very productive. I chose the latter, but, I like how you said, did I worry about that, like when the book came out?
Yeah.
And it's funny because I wasn't even thinking. That would probably have required me to step out of myself and see things from other people's perspectives. If people start self-diagnosing themselves like crazy and all of a sudden there's a huge rash of people running around thinking they have Asperger's, I don't know. It couldn't hurt to look into it.
Yeah.
If you find out you don't, then you don't. If you find out you do, well, then I guess it was a good exercise.
Yeah. Well, and maybe it will lead you just, whether you have it or not, to think more about the way you behave. And in some ways, that's what happened to you.
Exactly. In the end, I didn't care if we were calling it Asperger's, if I was just clinically self-centered, totally selfish, clueless, socially clueless, call all those things. When you break down Asperger's and, you know, put the prism in front of Asperger's and you see the whole spectrum of behaviors individually, and all of a sudden I have all these behaviors that add up to look like it, but it's not really. I didn't really care what we were calling it. I didn't care what the label was. The real value in doing this exercise, just like you said, that's a great point, is at the end you find out this is how I operate. These are some of the behaviors that have driven a wedge between me and my wife. These are some of the things that I can control. These are some of the things that still confuse me. At that point, it doesn't matter what you're calling it, and it doesn't matter if you have a diagnosis. As long as you understand how you operate and are the choices you're making in your life leading you to your best possible life. Mm-hmm. If they are, keep making them. If they're not, maybe you can change some of the choices that you make throughout the day.
Ben, thanks for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Anne is with us in South Jordan. Anne, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment. I have had a similar experience. My husband and I went to a class on parenting autism. I have a daughter with autism, and my husband came home and said, that was a really interesting class. I realized I see where she comes from. That moment when we realized that he had those same characteristics, and he probably fits in the Asperger's, changed our marriage in a way that I was able to understand him, and he then tried, more to understand me. We tried to understand each other. And the other thing is that I realized, the world can't go around without people who have Asperger's. My husband is a brilliant mechanic, and I certainly couldn't do what he can do. I really appreciate you sharing your experience. And I think that for any couple who might be in the same situation, that knowledge is power, and it changes the way you can relate to each other. Mm.
Yeah, Anne makes a great point. I mean, knowledge being transformative is huge. And also, the gifts, there are so many gifts given to the world from the autism and Asperger's population. You know, we're a small 1%, but we're quite mighty, and we contribute so much. You know, one of the greatest things about an obsessive mind that can turn a singular focus onto a topic and just go into it at the exclusion of everything else. Okay, so we're occasionally going to stumble our way through a party, and we might not remember to send you a birthday card or whatever it is. Or we might send you a birthday card reminding you that our birthday is coming up. we're not processing the things that we'll give that to the neurotypical world. You guys do well at parties. We'll go into the lab and we'll like invent the iPhone. we'll do things like this, and then we'll all just meet in the middle.
Yeah.
And and everything will just work out.
You know, Anne, thanks very much. At some point in this project of self-improvement, I mean, it became really enough for Kristen. I mean, she told you that at some point, look, it's not helping as much as it's disrupting. I mean, you had been involving her. And that the book talks about, you know, the project, the journal that you keep, of course, that hence the title. But, you're insisting that she participate in all of this. And I want to play another clip from the This American Life program, because it's a moment when Kristen is sort of coming to the point where she is kind of finished with the experiment, you know, the Journal of Best Practices. Here's another moment from the program This American Life.
That's the point where, we ordered out or something and he ate all the crab rangoon. And I just kind of was like, oh, you ate all the crab rangoon. And all of a sudden now that's a best practice. So that's kind of where I stopped it. And I said, you know what? We don't have to work on this for the next 3 weeks. Just don't eat all the crab rangoon. And so I had to explain to him, you know, people who are married still, it's okay if I sigh and roll my eyes when you eat all the crab rangoon. Like, that's okay. Best practices is done. We have the essentials. The things that were really difficult for us, we got, you know, leave the crab rangoon out of it.
And that must have been hard for him.
It was. That was one of the best practices that I gave him. I was like, here's your new best practice. Not everything is a best practice. And so I'm sure he went and ran and wrote it down in his journal. Like, okay, not everything's a best practice.
How important was that revelation, not to make everything a best practice?
See how lucky I am. Like,
it's true. You really are, David. You really are lucky.
I am. I've got this guide who's like unbelievable, like this angel just showing up every morning and saying like, okay, you know, I love that clip. That's great. That revelation was huge. It was as important as learning that, you know, there were things I had to work on in
there.
And, I took it too far. I tend to complicate things. this Journal of Best Practices, just to give you some background here, if people aren't aware, I just wrote constantly. I was writing notes to myself, everywhere. Post-it notes, things I could do. Apologies don't count when you shout them. Don't shout your apologies. put the laundry away instead of taking it out of the dryer, just like the one pair of socks you need.
Yeah.
And anything I could do. And it became a little much. How quickly can I mow the lawn today? Because she thought it was taking me a little bit longer than it should to mow the lawn. Like only because we were late going to a family picnic. And she's like, you've been out here for 2 hours. We don't have a huge yard. What are you doing? It's like, I'm trying to get the lines perfectly straight. It's like, hurry up. And so it's little things like that were nuisances that in and of themselves she could tolerate.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, if you have a little bit of a headache, going in and demanding like brain surgery. I want to rewire my neural network so I don't have this particular headache anymore. It's like that's a lot more damaging and a lot more taxing to just go and, you know. So what I had to learn was sometimes I'm just going to annoy her.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the reason why is because of the level of involvement. I think that if I was doing all this quietly behind the scenes, without asking her to participate, she wouldn't really care what I was up to.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, you know, every night, kids go to bed, you know, she wants to sit down and just veg out for a few hours, read a book, I don't know, watch TV or something. And I come to her and I say, like, all right, it's go time. Here are the things I've been working on this week. I'm going to project them on the wall from my computer, and we're going to go item by item how I'm doing. Let's rate my rate my progress. It's very pragmatic. You know, what gets measured gets done. Very businessy, but not for her. And she was thinking, like, you know, this cannot be our life.
Yeah.
She was sick of talking about self-improvement. Like, let's just talk about, you know, our favorite cheeses for a couple minutes. And
but you know,
I had to learn this.
Here's the thing, David, though. I think the kind of crucial point, at least for me, when you talk about this, was that you say in the book that it really took a lot of trust for you to allow yourself to let things go, to just say, she's not going to leave me. She's with me. I mean, she had to kind of comfort you about that, but it took an element of trust for you to say, all right, she does love me. She does accept me for who I am, and I think it's going to be okay.
Hugely insightful. My God, what a great – I love that. This is a fun interview. You're absolutely right, and trust works in a strange way. It's like the more someone gives you assurances, the less trust can thrive.
Yeah.
And assurances after a certain point do nothing, because if you're creative and intellectual at all, your brain starts sleuthing and you start thinking, oh, wait a minute, you know, I'm just being told what I want to hear, and then all of a sudden everything goes out the window. I was concerned. There was a lot at stake. Here's this amazing, I mean, you hear how amazing she is on the radio and everything. Like, here's this brilliant woman I'm married to, like an angel, and I got to make this right. And all of a sudden I felt an urgency. And here's an interesting thing about empathy is that if I truly understood at that moment back then, like a couple of years ago, how much I actually meant to her, the impact I made on her life on a daily basis, what emotions she felt when she thought of me, when she saw me, when she was around me, how good she felt. If I understood that, I wouldn't have been so urgent and anxious about, like, oh my God, she could leave me at any second because I've been such a toad for our entire marriage. It was almost like that misunderstanding, because I didn't have that insight into her. She could tell me all day long, I'm fine, things are good, don't worry about it, relax. But until you truly understand it and believe it and feel it for yourself, you don't act from that place. You act from a place of total fear. And that helped me. That gave me a nervous energy that motivated me to fix things. But as we're talking about now, things went a little too far. And that's when she said, you know what? You know what doesn't jeopardize our relationship is you eating the last of the Wheat Thins and putting the box back in the pantry. And I find it and it's empty and I'm ticked. She's like, that makes me mad. What jeopardizes our relationship is not being able to enjoy moments together. And it's impossible to enjoy moments together when we're sitting there fretting over how you could do something better that day. So just knock it off, be annoying once in a while, and, you know, I'll get over it in 2 seconds, and then we can just enjoy our day together. So it wasn't until she brought this to my attention that our relationship really, truly crystallized once again and became something that we could both just really enjoy every day.
David Finch is with us. His book is called The Journal of Best Practices, a memoir of marriage, Asperger's syndrome, and one man's quest to be a better husband. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with David Finch. We're talking about his book, The Journal of Best Practices, a memoir of marriage, Asperger's syndrome, and one man's quest to be a better husband. Let's go to the phones again. Amanda is with us in Salt Lake City. Amanda, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I have a son who was diagnosed with Asperger's, and I was wondering, what would you recommend me as a parent doing to help make my son successful and make navigating through life a little bit easier for him as he grows up?
Sure. Great question. And admittedly, one I can't perfectly answer without knowing you and your son and, you know, and his experiences with it and how difficult certain things are. But I will say this. There are some general things that I would recommend doing, you know, as you continue to raise your son and live life with him. And probably the biggest thing is to be his guide. I think one thing that when you're different, when you're wired differently, you find out you have Asperger's, you uh, you get off the plane, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of, like, you know, rural China, and you know, you're not like the people around you, and you're not your culture, your entire cultural background is different. Like, your son is coming from a different cultural background. I say that my wife Kristen and I are in a neurologically mixed marriages, you know, because we're just two completely different cultures coming together. As a parent, and I think this is true of any parent, but certainly a parent with Asperger's, to be his guide to the neurotypical world, to continue to explain very matter-of-factly, you know, kind of how the neurotypical world works. And, you know, if you want to provide some strategies for integrating into that world, more power to you. That's great. I think another thing parents need to provide to their children is constant love. And just find out what, you know, they have the love languages. I think there's that book out there, the Love Languages of Children, whatever it is. Find out what love language makes sense to your son. Is it continual praise? Is it, you know, spending time together? Providing love, trying to be understanding, and being that willing guide to the neurotypical world are so important. And another thing is advocating. And advocating goes kind of off in two directions. One being that when you see that he has needs that are very unique and particular, you know, what kid doesn't have needs, but if you see that he has some particular needs that are not being met, advocate, like in the schools or wherever you need to make that experience, to see if there's any way that you can maybe help those experience. Help his needs be accommodated, help him be accommodated in a way that's not really pushing the boundaries of, you know, your propriety, basically. Yeah. But the other thing you need to do is advocate, kind of teach him how to advocate for himself. Teach him how to be independent. Teach him how to be adaptable and flexible, you know, because he's not always going to have advocates and champions holding his hand throughout adulthood. So doing what you can is good, and doing what you can to help him stand on his own feet and be very independent is even better. I think those are the things that would probably make the greatest impact in your son's life.
Amanda, good luck. Thanks very much. There's this moment, David Finch, I wanted to ask you about. It's at this wedding reception you go to in South Carolina, and you know, things seem to be really going well. I mean, you're working really hard at it, trying to, you know, have fun and be fun. And there's this point in the evening, it's working really well. And Kristen asks you, are you actually having fun tonight, or is this just an act? And it kind of gets at that question about whether or not this is true empathy that's going on. I mean, have you conceded that it won't ever really be true empathy, that you have to work at it a little bit? I mean, what do you make of that idea, that question?
Yeah, I loved, you know, when she asked, first of all, empathy is a really hard thing to wrap your head around, to pin down. Is this real empathy? Does it count?
Yeah, yeah.
I think, you know, I've taken my empathy. There's like the empathy quiz, and out of 80 points, I scored like a 15. It's like, oh.
Wow.
You know, but I know that I can read people. I know that. I've I can do it over the phone even. I can tell if you're hustling along and want this interview to go better. I can change how I'm doing the interview for you. That's empathy. But I loved her question. You know, she said, is this for real? And it was. I was actually enjoying myself because I had created a set of parameters that would allow me to enjoy myself.
Yeah.
And it was forced. I forced it upon myself. In that moment, I said, this is the wedding. I'm not going to be the opposite of fun, and I'm going to kick it up a notch, and I'm actually going to try to have my own fun to see what happens. It was an experiment. So it was definitely contrived, and it worked. But, you know, you set up these parameters for yourself a few times, and you live your life accordingly, and all of a sudden it starts to become second nature. So if Kristen and I were to just happen upon like a gathering, I would probably be in there for a few minutes before it clicked with me and I realized, like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm at a party and I need to pay attention to how I'm doing things. In a way, some of these things do kind of become second nature. And, you know, as for the whole empathy thing, I think that if it's not true empathy, I'm okay with that. Who really knows? You know, some scientists will tell you that it's not true empathy. Some PhD somewhere will tell you that it is empathy, and nobody really knows what they're talking about, I guess, in the end. Or maybe everybody knows what they're talking about in the end.
Right.
And all I know is that with Kristen and I decided, look, I'm going to learn how to just tune in and really pay attention to what she needs. And if I'm wrong or if I need clarification, I'm going to talk to her about it. I'm going to say, you look like you're frustrated about something. Am I right about this? Mm-hmm. No. And, you know, you're not right about it. I'm not frustrated. I'm just tired and I just want to chill out. I don't know exactly what emotions are churning inside of her. And maybe I never will, but I do know in that moment it's probably enough just to back off. Because what will annoy her is if I continue the line of questioning. Well, you seem annoyed. You're not talking. Now that's going to get annoying pretty quick. And I've learned that. So it's kind of more intellect getting me there and reason and logic, and hopefully it counts. I know when we spoke with Ira Glass, he had asked us this great question. At the end of the interview, and he asked Kristen, so does this count?
Yeah.
And Kristen, does this count as real empathy? Does it even matter to you that he's doing this if it's not, like, truly feeling your emotions? And Kristen thought for about 10 minutes, and I was like, oh, my gosh.
Wow.
Like, Ira, help a dude out.
Yeah.
Like, things are working. Don't rock the boat for me, you know? And it was hilarious. I'm, like, sweating it out. And finally, Kristen was like, yeah, I think. Like, who dodged a bullet? But, you know, I think I have a sense of humor about it, obviously. But I think the fact of the matter is that it might not be true empathy, but if I'm willing to be responsive to Kristen's needs, tune in, and that's something we can both work with.
Yeah.
And that, in the end, feels pretty good for both of us.
It's David Finch. His book is called The Journal of Best Practices, A Memoir of Marriage, Asperger's Syndrome, and One Man's Quest to Be a Better Husband. David, thanks.
Thank you so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.